So hello, everyone. This is Mireille Janot, and you're listening to the New Books in African American Studies podcast. Today, we have as our guest, Professor Lauren Areza, author of To March for Others, The Black Freedom Struggle and the United Farm Workers, published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. Dr. Areza, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Great. I wonder if you'd begin by saying a few words about yourself, where you were born, perhaps, or where you went to school, and how you became a historian.
So I was born in I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area. I went to the college at Williams College in Massachusetts with actually the intention of being a scientist. I went in as a biology major, and I did major in biology, got my BA in that. But I also minored in African American studies. And by my junior year, realized that I enjoyed my minor much more than my major. But I was almost finished with my major.
Right.
So I completed it. And after graduating, decided I wanted to go further with African American studies and talk to one of my professors, asking him, you know, what he suggested, and he suggested history because he thought it would give me a broad foundation. And I had taken maybe, I don't know, 4 history classes in college, but I had done, you know, so much coursework with African American studies that I was able to get into graduate school. So I received my PhD in history from UC Berkeley. So I tell my current students that it doesn't really matter what you major in.
Right.
Because I didn't get the history through the traditional way, and now I'm an associate professor of history at Denison University.
Right. So it's definitely a lot about the journey. So that's great. So, please tell us how you came to write To March for Others.
Well, it began as my doctoral dissertation. I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and following college but before graduate school, I worked as a research assistant at the Martin Luther King Jr. Papers Project at Stanford University. And from growing up in California and working at the King Papers at Stanford, I started to question the very dominant Southern narrative of the civil rights movement. And especially myself, I'm a Latina, and having grown up in a very multiracial, multicultural area, the kind of very black-white paradigm that the movement is framed in didn't match with my reality, with my upbringing, with my lived experience. So I started by just looking at Black and Chicano interaction and cooperation during the era of civil rights. So I went to do research at Wayne State University, where the United Farm Workers papers are housed, and found so much on the UFW's alliances with various civil rights and black power organizations that became my focus, and that became my way in. So this was my dissertation, but then I radically revised it for the book, To March for Others.
Okay.
I'm really trying to focus what the book does, which the dissertation doesn't do, is really focus on what makes a cross-racial coalition possible. So what this book is doing is looking at the various approaches and attitudes towards cross-racial coalition building within the Black freedom struggle. So I'm using the UFW as a lens to see how the major civil rights organizations dealt with this strategy of coalition building.
Okay. Yeah, and in your first chapter, you discuss the sort of historical alliance between the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the SNCC, and the National Farm Workers, which eventually the NFWA, which eventually became UFW. Can you right. say more, I guess, about this coalition and its role in the founding of a broader rights movement?
Right. So the first alliance, I talk about five different civil rights and black power organizations. The first organization of the black freedom struggle that starts to work with, as you pointed out, what starts as the National Farm Workers Association, and then later the United Farm Workers, is the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And the foundation of that is really SNCC's ideology and organizational practice. Their whole operation and their organizing is based on combating both racial discrimination, but also economic exploitation. Because the people they're working with in the Deep South are people who are relegated to sharecropping and other manual labor because of both racial discrimination and their class position. And so when SNCC organizers in California encounter the farm workers, it resonates with them because it's very what the United Farm Workers are doing in trying to unionize in order to get safer working conditions and better treatment and higher pay. What they're doing and then the way that the growers are treating them and then the way the law enforcement in places like Delano, California are aligning themselves with the growers and persecuting the farm workers resonates because it's exactly what's happening to sharecroppers who are trying to demand their rights in the Deep South. Mm-hmm. So SNCC begins first by sending supplies. They're sending two-way radios to help with strikes and picket lines. They send cars. And they send organizers. It's not just about, oh, here's some money, here's some supplies, mm-hmm. good luck. They send people to conduct courses in nonviolent resistance. Because although Cesar Chavez, the leader of the farm workers, was nonviolent and very committed to it, it didn't mean that all the farm workers were.
Right, of course.
And so he recognized that he needed some assistance in teaching the farm workers how to best employ nonviolent resistance. So he calls upon the San Francisco office of SNCC and asks them to send some organizers. So members of SNCC and also a few from the Congress on Racial Equality go and teach these courses. And Chavez had called them because he was very aware of what was happening in the South and civil rights movement. And he said, well, you know, he knew that they had the experience in this kind of activism. Mm-hmm. And so he sends, so CORE and SNCC go and they teach these classes on nonviolent resistance and, you know, CORE then moves on to other projects, but SNCC's base, SNCC, especially the San Francisco chapter, continues to work with and support the farm workers. They're on picket lines, they're organizing, donations, whether, you know, for food and clothing for striking farm workers. They're writing about what the farm workers are doing it and publishing it in SNCC's newspaper, which was distributed nationwide. So they're also educating mm-hmm. Other activists on what the farm workers are doing and really presenting it in a way that shows this is one struggle. Right? This is not like a separate movement. This is exactly what, you know, in line with what SNCC was doing.
Right. These are all strands in a single broad struggle.
Right. And that reflects SNCC's larger ethos. I mean, SNCC's newspaper was called The Movement.
Right. Right.
And as I say very often when I speak about this, activists at this era didn't describe themselves as being part of a single movement. They didn't say, I'm a civil rights activist.
I'm
in the Chicano movement. I'm in the Red Power movement. That's not how they envisioned what they were doing. That's not how they envisioned themselves. They said, I'm part of the movement. And so they themselves envisioned it as one huge movement. It's only after, in hindsight, or, you know, from observers who have kind of separated these movements, you know, and studied them individually, but the activists themselves saw it as one large struggle.
Yeah, and that is very interesting, because it does, in fact, like, as you say, just even the terms that they use to describe what they're engaged in, whether it's la causa or, you know, the movement. I mean, this idea that it's not civil rights, or it's not only civil rights, it's also economic rights, class, you know, equality, really points to the broadness of that mission. So it's really interesting. The something, I guess, that might, I guess, militate against that sort of unified ethos might be the sort of issues of race that begin to come up within SNCC in the mid 60s. You talk about this in the second chapter. Can you say more about this and the impact that it had on coalition building?
Yeah, I mean, what happens in SNCC, as I talk about in the second chapter, I mean, their ethos, their ideology, their praxis changes dramatically. You know, mostly in reaction to what they're experiencing in the South. And they start de-emphasizing the class struggle, right? They start to prioritize race, mm-hmm. and putting that and looking at Black unity and Black power as more important. And they're doing this, as I mentioned in the book, it's reactionary, but and not necessarily how we would expect. Part of it is that when they encounter self-sufficient Black communities in the South, they're really inspired.
Mm-hmm.
Right? These are communities that are, they're cohesive, they're powerful, they're looking at Lowndes County especially, where Black office holding becomes possible because of the large number of Black landowners.
Mm-hmm.
And so integration and this kind of cross-racial cooperation becomes less important to SNCC. Not only becomes unimportant, but it just isn't their focus anymore.
Right.
But what that means for the farm workers is that then the farm workers are no longer a priority. And SNCC also starts to turn its attention away from rural and becomes more interested in organizing in urban areas, especially given the urban rebellions that were, you know, that start happening, particularly in the Northeast in the late 60s. And so the shift of priorities means that they're not as committed to this alliance with the farm workers. The alliance doesn't serve the same ends that it had before. It's no longer really part of their, as I said, part of their priorities. And so it's one of my readers somebody who read my book told me that they found my second chapter to be sad.
I might echo that. Yeah,
because it's like the first chapter with SNCC and the National Farm Workers Association coming together, there's so much promise there.
Right.
And you can see, you know, how much, you know, SNCC's participation is really essential to the National Farm Workers. I mean, SNCC's organizing, you know, helps with, you know, the boycotting on Shenley Industries. They help with the success of the Delano to Sacramento March. And then, you know, a couple of years later, the alliance is over.
Right.
With the exception of a couple, you know, Marshall Gans, who basically switches from being in SNCC to being in the United Farm Workers.
Mm-hmm.
And it happens pretty seamlessly. But aside from that, the alliance pretty much dissolves. And the leadership of the farm workers, particularly Cesar Chavez, find it jarring.
Right.
You know, whereas this kind of ideological evolution in SNCC happens, you know, pretty organically, it's still jarring to SNCC's allies.
Right.
And so Chavez is kind of, you know, confused as to why he's not getting this support anymore. And so, yes, it's, yeah, I didn't realize that, that chapter two would be so, so sad, but.
Yeah, because I, yeah. Right. And I think too, as, sort of as you alluded, to before, in hindsight, you know, we think as readers, we maybe think, oh boy, we're sort of seeing the same type of thing, you know, you have this sense of deja vu, maybe, you know, sort of disintegrations of coalitions that you see the hallmarks of that in retrospect, which, again, you know, talking about Chavez's confusion about why this was no longer the way it was, how it started out, mm-hmm. you know, would sort of account for that because, you know, when it's happening, you don't quite realize, you know, all the reasons. And even in hindsight, I guess you don't really realize all the reasons. Yeah.
Right. And also, and part of that is that, you know, communication networks are different. So Chavez and the farm workers are mostly working with the San Francisco SNCC office.
Mm-hmm.
And the SNCC chapters in the South, you know, sign off on what San Francisco is doing. But SNCC chapters in various places pretty much worked independently.
Because
mm-hmm. The idea was, you know, the emphasis on the grassroots, what's needed in that particular community. And so Mike Miller and others in San Francisco SNCC decided that, you know, this was what was needed. And so, you know, the leadership in the South were like, okay, fine, do what you want. But it's not, they weren't as involved. And so the changes that happened in SNCC come from the Southern leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but that ends up, you know, affecting the San Francisco SNCC office because then, you know, it dissolves.
Right.
Yeah. So it's definitely a lines of communication, you know, so Chavez is talking with San Francisco SNCC and these changes are happening in Atlanta and he's not really privy to that.
Right.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, and throughout the book, you do sort of point out geography along with, you know, things like class and languages, factors that we look at less frequently, when talking about, you know, race relations in this country, accustomed as we are to focusing on the black-white binary. But this idea of geography influencing the lines of communication and that kind of thing, could you actually just say more about the role of geography, whether in the sort of dominant discourse or just, you know, in more specific terms like communication?
Right. I mean, geography, and this is another way that the book is very different from the dissertation, because I really don't get into geography at all in the dissertation. But the more I revise, the more I realize that, you know, the place is really central to coalition building and whether or not it's going to happen, because, you know, factors in one area are not the same factors in another area. And, you know, in California, coalition building is, or had historically been, pretty common. I talk about that quite a lot as far as, you know, the ways in which African-Americans and Mexican-Americans and Asian-Americans were able to come together in Los Angeles in the 1940s. And part of this is the African-American community in the West was relatively small in proportion to the rest of the population. So if you're going to make social change, you need support, right? You need allies. And then also just given the diversity of certain areas, especially Los Angeles, the San Francisco Bay Area, they are regions remarkable for their diversity. And so cross-racial coalition building makes sense because people out here are operating in a multiracial context,
mm-hmm.
whereas in the South, it's a little harder to demonstrate the importance of that kind of strategy because as you point out, you know, it's a black-white binary. I mean, yes, the South has become much more diverse since some of the immigration reform of the 1980s, but in the 1960s and 70s, the Latino population in the South ranged from about 0.1 to 0.4%, depending on the state.
Right.
That's tiny.
Right.
So the idea of, you know, working with Latinos in this context just didn't really make sense. It didn't match up with the demographics of the South and the realities and race relations in the South.
Mm-hmm.
And so then, you know, you asked about communication. So then you have this struggle, and you see it with SNCC, but you also see it with the NAACP that I talked about in my third chapter,
mm-hmm.
where you have these activists on the West Coast who are like, well, yeah, of course we need to do this. We need to do this kind of coalition building to do our work. And they're trying to explain this to their leadership in the Northeast or in the South, and the leadership's just not getting it because they don't operate in that context. They're not aware of those dynamics. They're not as knowledgeable of, you know, of Mexican-Americans. And so then you have San Francisco SNCC and you have the West Coast Regional NAACP basically, you know, talking to a wall. They're just not really getting through to leadership in the East about why this matters. So then you end up getting tension between the West Coast chapters and the national leadership in the East. Because they're not on the same page at all as far as, you know, the direction that, you know, they want to go.
And in that same chapter, you also sort of talk about the leadership of the United Farm Workers Organizing Committee and their, you know, eventual concern with the support of the Black Panther Party, right? That seemed, you know, that's another area of contention. Can you say a bit more about that?
I'm sorry. What do you mean about the concern?
Well, right. So in the third chapter, you sort of talk about how the UFWOC's support of the Black Panther Party caused quite a bit of disagreement. You know, inside and outside of the union, just because of the sort of obviously, you know, going away from the nonviolent sort of mode of operation and the concerns about that. And so I'm just wondering, yeah, if you could say a bit more.
Sure.
About,
I mean,
that point of dissent.
I guess, you know, there was some concern. So when the leadership of the, I guess it was the United Farm Workers Organizing Committee at the time, when they began an alliance with the Black Panther Party, some members of the union are concerned because, you know, there's been this whole emphasis, as you pointed out, on nonviolence, and now there's this alliance with this group, you know, that emphasizes self-defense. And then you have other labor unions. So the example I talk about is this man from a woodworkers union in Oregon,
mm-hmm.
Right, Chavez, very alarmed. But, you know, how can you possibly support them? The thing that's challenging about writing about the UFW is, yes, it's a Chicano organization, but then at the same time, it's a union.
Right, exactly.
So they're within the AFL-CIO. So then there's this whole other set of dynamics. And the thing with the farm workers, though, with the UFW, is it's a very, as much as it talks about the democracy and the empowerment of the farm workers, it's really pretty much a top-down organization. So if Chavez says, we're going to support the Black Panther Party, they're supporting the Black Panther Party.
Right, which he does.
Right. And
right.
So he does, and he explains why, and nobody's going to argue with him.
Right.
So it happens. So there is a bit of that concern, but, you know, going back to this place, right, that the Black Panther Party is West Coast-centered,
mm-hmm.
You know, Chavez had experience prior to being in the farm, to leading the farm workers when he was with the community service organization. You know, remember, he starts his career as an organizer in San Jose.
Mm-hmm.
So he's in San Jose, he's in Oakland, and so he's already been immersed in this very multiracial context. And so when the Black Panthers, you know, start organizing what they're doing, even, you know, even though he disagrees with some elements of what they're doing, it makes sense. But then also he's, you know, he was very intelligent and he understood what a lot of people didn't understand was that in preaching self-defense, the Panthers weren't necessarily advocating violence,
right,
despite how fiery their rhetoric was at certain times. You know, self-defense is in many ways just an extension of nonviolence. Like, you know, if you're nonviolent towards me, I'm nonviolent towards you.
Right.
It's, you know, but I'm not going to be nonviolent if you're attacking me. You know,
right,
that's
right.
Really what the band. And so Chavez understood that, you know, and he understood that his full, you know, commitment to nonviolence, you know, embraced by Gandhi, wasn't something that everyone could do.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, you know, even though he had some disagreements, he understood and appreciated what the Black Panther Party was doing. So there was some concern, but he pretty much, you know, quells that. Yeah.
Right. And he quells that. And again, sort of to your point about his personal convictions about, you know, sort of the Gandhian notion of nonviolent resistance. He shares that. He shares that with Martin Luther King, but King, again, sort of to one of your earlier points, is not perhaps not as convinced of the value of an alliance with Chavez.
Right.
Yeah. Can you say more about that particular relationship?
Yeah, so my fourth chapter on the relationship between the UFW and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, I think, is probably my most shocking chapter, my most surprising chapter, because, I mean, even I went into it, this project, with an assumption that there was some sort of alliance between King and Chavez. But then, as I said, you know, I worked at the King Papers Project, and I only found these two telegrams that King had ever sent to Chavez. And so, you know, I want to see, well, what, you know, what else is there? So, you know, I go to Weinstein, I look in the archives, and that's all there is. Wow. There's these two telegrams.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, the general public has linked King and Chavez in their imaginations. And they're mentioned in the same breath very often. Chavez is often called, you know, like the Chicano Martin Luther King.
Right.
And I believe the UFW even has, like, just something named after him. I think, like, an award or something.
Right. They're often, so, you know, standing together in murals.
Yeah. Right. And, you know, I've even read books where that claimed that they met. And I was like, no. They never met.
Right.
They didn't work together. They were terribly interested in working with each other. And when I tell people this, they get kind of upset.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like I'm trying to, you know, destroy this image that they have, but I'm sorry, it's just not what happened. So I got one of my professors in graduate school just had the hardest time wrapping his mind around this.
Mm-hmm.
And then I presented a paper at the Conference of the Organization of American Historians a few years ago on the fact that there is really no relationship between King and Chavez. And I got kind of yelled at during the discussion section. You know, this is by other historians. And they were really upset about this. But, you know, so whereas other chapters deal with maybe multiple organizations, I really had to, the fourth chapter, I really have to explain why it doesn't happen. You know, there's many, many reasons. It's not like, there's some scholars who said, oh, well, they were just both busy. Well, yes, they were very busy, but, you know, they did manage to work with other people. So what's exactly happening here? You know, so part is, you know, is place, as we've talked about. The King is in Atlanta. He's operating within a black-white binary. He's operating in an urban area. So you have this struggle by, you know, Chicanos, which he's totally unfamiliar, in a rural area. It's just completely outside of what he's doing. It's not part of, you know, his program. He becomes interested in the farm workers when he gets to the Poor People's Campaign in 1968. But by that time, you know, the farm workers are in the midst of a boycott. Mm-hmm. They've mm-hmm. already gotten a lot of publicity. They've already got a lot of supporters, and King Works reaches out to them, and it's too late.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're in the midst of their own struggle, and they're like, I'm not putting this on hold for the Poor People's Campaign.
Right, so in a sense, these become sort of competing movements.
Right, right. Well, not necessarily competing, but it's just...
Competing,
you know,
for attention, if nothing else, right.
Yeah, and, you know, some of the farm workers or some of the volunteers who are organizing this boycott on the East Coast are like, hey, can we go participate in the Poor People's Campaign? And Chavez says, no, like, mm-hmm. we've got our own struggle. We have enough to do. Like, we don't have time for this. And he doesn't say it, but what I argue is that, Chavez is like, you know, when has SCLC supported us?
Right, right.
And now they want us to drop everything and go support them? Like, no, that's not how an alliance really works. So part of it, as I said, is geography and the fact that this is just totally outside of King's realm.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it, I argue, is class. That
mm-hmm.
these are impoverished agricultural workers. That's also not really King's background.
Mm-hmm.
He's from a established family in Atlanta. And that's, you know, the people in SNCC and the Black Panther Party who work with farm workers are people who have a background in rural agricultural labor.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So they're able to make that class-based connection that the King's really not able to make.
Mm-hmm.
And then part of that is, just, you know, going back to the fact that, you know, despite the fact that the farm workers are also fighting for racial equality, they're a union, right? And Chavez himself said, I'm not a civil rights leader, I'm a union leader.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some scholars who argue that King was very pro-labor, that he courted labor, but really the evidence shows that King had a very conflicted relationship with organized labor.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted economic justice. He wanted employment equality. He knew that unions could be a powerful source of support, especially within the Democratic Party. But, you know, he also knew that unions discriminated.
Right.
So he, when he talks to unions, it's really, there's a recent book of speeches that he gives to unions, and some argue that this is proof of his close relationship with labor. But if you look at the speeches, they're really, he's asking for, you know, he's doing two things. He's asking for financial support from the unions,
mm-hmm.
and then he's also criticizing them for allowing discrimination to continue within their locals.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So he's got this very conflicted relationship with unions. So when the UFW comes to prominence, he's, you know, due to his lack of familiarity with Mexican-Americans and their issues in the West, he's not seen it as like, oh, here's this other movement for racial equality.
Right.
Here's another union.
Right, right.
Right. And so, you know, why would I, you know, work with them?
Right. So that just kind of compounds whatever wariness he already has.
Right, right. And so, as I said, you know, his thinking evolves and he becomes much more attuned to what they're doing. But by this time, the farmer, you know, the UFW and Chavez are not really impressed. Like, they've already formed several other multiracial coalitions, and they don't, you know, feel compelled to work within the Poor People's Campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And then plus, you know, as I talk about the Poor People's Campaign, although it addresses poverty, it doesn't really address labor.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't reach out to labor unions. And so the UFW leadership doesn't really see the value in participating in the Poor People's Campaign. So, but, you know, then as I show in that same chapter, the relationship with the UFW and SCLC changes after King's assassinated.
Right, exactly.
Because Ralph Abernathy takes the helm.
Yeah.
And he's a very different style of leader. He grows up with an agricultural background in rural Alabama. He's very familiar with rural poverty, with agricultural labor. He also, you know, comes in at a time when SCLC is losing support.
Mm-hmm.
And so he understands the value of working with the farm workers in a way that King had not.
Right. And as well as King's widow, as you mentioned.
And same with Coretta Scott King, that she comes also from rural Alabama, from an impoverished agricultural background. And so she understands what the farm workers are doing in a way that her husband had not. But then also, you know, one of the things I point out is, you know, these coalitions really have to benefit everyone involved. It can't just be one-sided. And so for Coretta Scott King, it's a way for her to demonstrate her own skills as an activist, and to bring prominence to the King Center, which she had just established. So an alliance between UFW and SCLC does happen, but not until King has been assassinated, is no longer president.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, that's the thing that tends to surprise people the most in reading this book. I was invited to give a book talk as part of the King holiday, and I said, you might want to read chapter 4 before. And so it ended up that I did give a talk there, but it wasn't for the King holiday.
Sure.
It was for something else. Sure. So, yeah.
Really interesting. Yeah, and again, sort of talking about that, some of what comes in the wake of King's assassination, in the fifth chapter, which is entitled "A Natural Alliance of Poor People," you talk a lot about Black Panther Bobby Seale's candidacy for mayor of Oakland, California. Which seems like an important turning point in the alliance between the UFW, certainly in the Black Panther Party, and in many senses sort of signaled an important end of some kind, in terms of these sorts of alliances or the potential for these sorts of alliances. Could you talk more about that?
Yeah, I mean, so as I pointed out, alliances make most sense when they benefit everyone involved and when there's an alignment of interests. And so when Bobby Seale runs for mayor of Oakland in 1973, it comes at a time where both the Panthers and the UFW is looking more towards electoral politics as a way to achieve social change. And so their interests are aligning more. Chavez sees the allure of having one of the farm workers' longtime supporters in public office in a position where he can, you know, both be a platform for the farm workers' issues, but then he could also make changes within Oakland City government that will benefit the farm workers. So I think this is probably, I'm not sure which would be more surprising about my book, the chapter where I talk about the lack of a relationship between Chavez and King, or the fact that I show that there's quite a productive alliance between the farm workers and the Black Panther Party. That's also what I think a lot of people wouldn't assume. But, you know, as I said, despite their differences, despite this, you know, emphasis on nonviolence and versus self-defense, that the farm workers and the Black Panther Party actually do have quite a bit in common as far as what they're trying to do. And again, so there's this shift for both of them and this interest in electoral politics, because the growers in California are also turning towards politics. Mm-hmm. They try to push through a proposition that will outlaw all agricultural boycotts, and they will and that will limit the ability of farm workers to unionize. So since the growers are turning to politics, it makes sense for the UFW also to turn that direction. And then same with the Black Panther Party. Some of their programs, you know, they had got quite a bit of community of popularity within the community for having these, what they call their survival programs. And those survival programs, particularly the Free Breakfast for Children program, starts to be picked up by government agencies. Also, like PTAs and church groups start doing their own breakfast programs. And they started saying, like, okay, we did this one program and look at the change that it's created. So what else could we do to create change from within?
Mm-hmm.
And then plus you have the rise of Black politicians and Black mayors in particular in other areas of the country. So you have Carl Stokes and people like that. And yeah. So they're like, okay, if this could happen in Cleveland, and it happens, of course, in Gary, Indiana, and they're like, well, you know, what can we do in Oakland then?
Right, right. Harold can Washington in Chicago. Yeah.
Exactly. So getting involved in electoral politics also then makes sense for the Black Panther Party. So Bobby Seale runs for mayor of Oakland, and even though, you know, he had a policy of not pursuing endorsements, he goes and asks Chavez to endorse his campaign, which Chavez happily does. And not only does he just send out a press release saying he's endorsing him, but he goes to Oakland. Mm-hmm. He goes to Oakland. He walks through the Spanish-speaking neighborhoods campaigning for Seale. He takes pictures with Seale that are used in campaign flyers that are printed in English and Spanish. And his support really does quite a lot to help elevate Seale's image within the Latino community in Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
So in just the same way that the survival programs really elevated the Panthers' image in the Black community,
mm-hmm.
the Chavez endorsement does the same thing in the Latino community. And although Seale doesn't win, he actually, you know, he does qualify for a runoff, and he does raise the visibility of certain concerns within the Latino community, such as bilingual election materials. And so he, even though he doesn't win, his platform does raise a lot of important issues and does pave the way for future Black office holders in Oakland. So it ends up being a very, even though, as I said, he doesn't win, it still ends up being, you know, very productive for both the farm workers and the Panthers and the Black and the larger Black and Latino communities in Oakland.
Well, and to that point, you know, I'm wondering if you could sort of tell us what you think the legacy is, if there is one, of these sorts of coalitions in contemporary politics or contemporary activism.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think, you know, what my book shows is that one, that coalitions are possible, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, people often think that there's just no way to bridge these divides and come together. I mean, you know, we're looking at groups here that are separated by race, by ethnicity, sometimes by language, you know, depending, religion, sometimes place. But yet, these groups actively sought out these alliances. They made an effort to work together. And then doing so paid out dividends. And so I think what my book shows is that, you know, coalition building is not just possible, but it's valuable. It's worth doing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it could be instructive for activists. And especially there's been a tendency, and I don't know if I'm, if this is kind of what I'm responding to or not, but there, you know, there's been a tendency, especially in the popular media, to really inflate any kind of conflict between blacks and Latinos. And I think it's gotten to the point, and I think other scholars agree with me on this, that it's gotten to the point where it makes people assume that conflict is just a natural state between blacks and Latinos, and that there's no possibility for coalition. You see this especially in the popular media in Los Angeles. And so there's been a proliferation of scholarship, you know, of which mine is included, that seeks to unpack Black-Latino relations. And so, you know, it's not just conflict. It's not strictly coalition either, but there are, you know, there are moments of both, and there's places in between coalition and conflict. It's not as negative as the dynamic as the media presents it. So there are these, you know, historical moments of coming together, and, you know, there are moments of coming apart as well. But it's much more complicated than, as I said, what the media presents it to be.
Interesting. Yeah, things are often more nuanced on the ground. Well, Dr. Areza, we have taken up a lot of your time, but I'm very interested to know what you might be working on right now.
So right now, I'm conducting research for a project. Somewhat of an offshoot of my book, and then in my book, when I talked about, I don't know, the final chapter, when I talked about the UFW and the Black Panther Party campaign in Oakland, one of the things that I mentioned is when the farm workers are campaigning in Oakland against Proposition 22, the Black Panther Party arranges for the farm workers to stay on the campus of Mills College, which is a very beautiful private women's college.
Right.
And so that kind of raised a flag for me. Mills is the oldest women's college in the West, and barely anything has been written on it. So what I am doing, I'm conducting research on the relationship between Mills College and the Black freedom struggle in Oakland. So both Oakland and Mills are founded in 1852.
Okay.
And Oakland kind of grows around Mills. When Mills is built, it's in the countryside. And now Mills is kind of in the middle of a working class, predominantly African-American neighborhood. So I want to see how the changing demographics, but also the movement for social change, particularly Black power in Oakland, affected Mills. So looking at the relationship between Oakland and the college, but then also looking at the activism of students at Mills that leads to the increased recruitment of students and faculty of color, and also leads to the creation of an ethnic studies department. And so Mills, and as I mentioned, Mills has been really left out. There's books about merit, about Berkeley, about Stanford, and really Mills hasn't been explored, which I find surprising, you know, given, as I said, it's the oldest women's college in the West. And it's right in the middle of Oakland. It's right across the highway from Merritt. So that is what I'm in the midst of researching. So right now I'm in residence in California conducting that research.
Wow. That sounds like a great project, and I definitely look forward to hearing more about it, and we'll certainly follow up with you, because we'd love, of course, to speak to you again about that project when it comes out in book form.
Wonderful.
Great. Well, thanks again very much for coming on the show. I've really enjoyed talking to you again. We've had the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Lauren Areza, author of To March for Others, The Black Freedom Struggle, and The United Farm Workers. Thanks again.
Thanks for having me.